Okay, folks, welcome to the latest edition, the latest chapter, the latest very exciting catalogue of adventures here on Planet Porky with myself, of course, the Portmeister, and the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, I can't tell you how thrilled I am as I sit here in my office studio down in Stockbroker Belt, Surrey. I hear the pitter patter of raindrops on my Velux window. When the rain came, da 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 da. That was a George Harrison song, wasn't it?
Do you know, that is the best drum solo by Ringo Starr of all recordings I can think of.
Really?
By the Beatles. Oh yeah, have a listen. Mm. Or to all the people who say Ringo was a useless drummer, I always say listen to Rain.
Yeah, really? I've never said he was a useless drummer. Many people say Ringo actually held the group together, not just, you know, by being diplomatic on the breakup between Lennon and McCartney, but in fact, his ability to drum, pull together, you know, the bass and the lead guitar and all that kind of stuff. I understand that the drummer and the bass player are usually the people who lead the band, don't they?
Well, yeah, it's the rhythm section, isn't it? It's the heartbeat of a band.
Yeah.
Without a rhythm section, you have no band.
Yeah.
So it is the drummer and the bass player together who do hold it all together.
That's right.
If you like, allowing the others to take center stage and shine. Yeah. There's a reason why they're always at the back.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Ringo didn't have an ego, did he? Because I think the only drum solo he ever did was on Abbey Road, wasn't it? A-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum. You know, and that was the only one he was ever encouraged to do.
Yeah, there were drum interludes, I suppose. When you listen to the whole track, you know, you can hear bits where the drums dominate and that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, right. I'm just remembering about the drum solo on Abbey Road. But anyway, there you go.
I find Abbey Road very difficult to listen to a lot of the time because it stirs up such emotion in me. I get too upset.
Yeah.
And, it sort of takes me back. The nostalgia is raw.
Yeah.
And it takes me right back to that period of my life. I remember where I was, who I interacted with, what I was doing.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's just too painful to
revisit. Well, everybody goes through that, Leslie. Not just you. Every song I hear evokes some story in my head. You know what I mean? A girlfriend, a new job, a job I got sacked from, a depressing incident overseas or something like that. You know what I mean? For instance, I remember being in the British Virgin Isles, okay? One of the most beautiful parts of the world. And we went to stay on Necker. Richard Branson's island, okay?
I've always wanted to go there.
Yeah, well, we're very lucky. We're invited. We happen to be around on Tortola, I think, which is the British Virgin Islands' biggest island. And somebody came along and said, how would you like to come over and have dinner on there? I thought, brilliant, you know, that kind of stuff. And we got over there, and the record I remember was a couple of guys who sang... look into my eyes, can't you see they're open wide? Would I lie to you, baby? Would I? And I've never heard it before, and I've never heard it since, but it's apparently a very great soul record or something, you know.
I can't remember who did that.
No,
anyway,
after that, after we'd had dinner, they said, I tell you what we do now, we always go for a cocktail to the Pirate's Pub. Oh, right, okay, sorry, you've got a pub on the island as well. Oh, no. And you get onto a Boston Whaler, one of those little boats, you know, that you drive yourself from the back, and literally a lump of rock in the Caribbean Sea was all fizzing with light as we got closer to it. And it was called the Pirate's Pub. It was on a lump of rock. Went in there. It was amazing. The first record that came on the jukebox, it had an old-fashioned jukebox, was That's Me in the Corner. Da-da-da, you know, Losing My Religion.
Losing My Religion, that's R.E.M., isn't it?
Absolutely.
I think the song you referred to before, wasn't that Charles and Eddie?
Charles and Eddie, well done.
It was 1990s.
Yeah, absolutely. And we were in Branson's lounge playing snooker. He had the only snooker table in the whole of the Caribbean, right? And that record sort of came on a loop, and we thought, wow, isn't that great?
Oh, sorry. Bloody phones are... Oh, sorry. Yeah. Sorry. I'm trying to turn the phone off and it won't turn off.
You said, right, have you switched the phone off, Mr. Brown?
You know what? I did. I switched it off, and maybe I somehow doubly switched it on. I don't know. I do apologise.
No problem at all. Perhaps it's the editor of the Sunday Express asking you to do another column next week. Could that be okay?
Well, I am doing another column for you next week, actually. Okay. I was appointed to write two columns, two in a row, because the regular columnist was taking holiday.
Yes.
I obviously jumped to the chance because once a hack, always a hack. We never get that ink out of our veins, do we, really? And it felt great to be back doing it. I was bristling with excitement while I was writing it. Yes. And it just feels so natural to me to be writing a column.
Yeah, lovely.
So it was great to do it. And I'm really looking forward to another one this week.
Great. And you touched in your column, of course, on one of our favourite subjects, that's Queen, who, despite my protestations that the Beatles will always be the greatest, have now officially been accorded the title of the biggest selling band of all time, haven't they?
Well, it's that one album, the Greatest Hits Greatest Hits Number One, which came out in 1981. And it's got things like Another One Bites the Dust and We Will Rock You and tracks like that on it, you know, classic Queen hits. And it's a bit like ABBA's Gold.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those CDs, let's say, you could, or however you listen to music these days, you can pull it up, stick it on, and everybody will jump up and start dancing. It's one of those great crowd pleasers of an album. Every single track a hit.
Yeah.
And it's gone past the 7 million mark in terms of sales and has become the most successful album in the UK of all time.
Yeah.
And I think the real reason is, apart from what I've just said, you know, about it being a great party banger, really, is that of these great classic bands, nobody's coming up through the ranks to replace them.
Of course they're not.
And it's the reason why the Stones are still out there, McCartney, we've got Springsteen about to go on the road. All of these great classic rock acts.
Yes.
We're not making those anymore.
Of course we're not.
And so we're milking them, or we're making the most of them, because we know we haven't got them for much longer.
That's right. I've had this theory for years, and I'm sure I've expounded it to yourself before, Ms. Jones, is that the explosion in the music culture 20 years after the Second World War, when people like Lennon and McCartney and Jagger and Richards and the Hollies and all, and the Kinks and all that, suddenly discovered a world made of colour instead of black and white. And I think they put together all the best combinations of musical notes and chords and that you could do. And I think the options have run out, because it was such a festival of invention and creation then. I don't think there's anything left.
But that's a bit like saying literature would run out because we've used up all the words.
I suppose so.
What are there, about 300,000 words in the English language, and combinations of words, sequences? You know, we've seen quite high-profile cases of accusations of plagiarism and so on.
Yeah.
Because somebody will say, well, you know, I wrote that phrase in my novel. How are you doing today? If you wrote that phrase, that doesn't become somebody's copyright.
Yeah.
And I kind of argue that it's the same thing with chord progressions and musical notes, really.
Yeah.
There are only so many of them, and it's unsurprising that sometimes somebody writes a song that sounds a little bit like something somebody else wrote.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. We had the conversation a few weeks ago, didn't we, about Ed Sheeran and being accused of that Queen. We'll move on in a minute, but that Queen Best Hits, I mean, that's a Best Hits compilation. That doesn't mean to say it's better than Sgt. Pepper's, because Sgt. Pepper's was an album. Do you see what I mean?
Well, yes, Sgt. Pepper is a concept album, and also, of course, it was a creation of alter egos. So it wasn't the Beatles performing as themselves, but as some characters who they'd invented. And that concept album is designed to be listened to from start to finish.
Yeah, sure.
Because it progresses almost like a story.
Yeah.
Well, it is a story.
Yeah.
But Greatest Hits is a compilation indeed. But nobody's saying that Queen's Greatest Hits is better than Sgt. Pepper's. It just has sold more copies.
Yeah, no, totally agree. Now, Ms. Jones, we have a labour shortage in this country. By the way, can I just say to you, the listeners might think that I'm sort of slurring my words at the moment. They may feel that I've been on the sauce. And I haven't for a number of reasons, which I'll tell you about in a moment. But I have just endured, it's to do with the jaw, about...
Endured or enjoyed?
No, endured. A jaw operation, not an operation.
Oh, God. Oh, no. I'm going to get squeamish here.
In the dentist chair. And
The
problem was, it was to try and fix the wisdom tooth. And the wisdom tooth, as I'm sure you know, any amateur dentist does, is right in the back of your mouth. So I've had my mouth clamped open for an hour and a half, and I've had the dentist go in there to do what he thought was a basic repair job, just a filling. But the minute he got into it, the tooth collapsed. And so I had a clamp then placed around the tooth, and it was filled with the dental equivalent of concrete. But each time a new procedure happened, I had to have another Novocaine injection in my gum.
Some people have paid good money for that.
I suppose they would. And I'm a real coward when it comes to dentists. And I just said, no, more, you know, I want more, no, I can't stop.
Did you have somebody with you, somebody to bring you home?
I had to leave my car there. I had so much Novocaine in the end, the doc said it wouldn't be wise for you to drive home now, so got taxi.
So how'd you get back?
I got a taxi. They ordered a taxi.
Okay. So I was going to say, you could fall in the road and get run over or something. You have to be very careful when you've had that
stuff. Yeah, well, the taxi took me from the door of the dentist to the door of my penthouse apartment in Stockbroker Belt, so there wasn't a risk there. You know, that was okay, but...
I'm surprised that you're even talking to me at all. You should be tucked up in bed.
I still can't feel the right-hand side of my face, to be honest, so that's...
Well, some people would find that an advantage, of course.
Yes, I suppose they would. But anyway, there we go. Back to staff shortages, okay?
Well, this
took place. I had a meeting in town earlier this week. In fact, in Carnaby Street. I love Carnaby Street because it's still got all the, you know, it's still got all the pizzazz and the flair and all that that it had when it became famous in the 60s. You know what I mean?
Well, the flair and the flares.
Yeah, the flair and the flares and all that kind of stuff. That's right. Yeah. Whilst I was there, I passed a swatch shop, and I thought it's time for a new fun watch. So I went and bought a new watch. For £125.
That's a bit different from a Rolex.
It is very different to a Rolex. Rolex.
Have you stopped wearing your Rolex?
I only wear my Rolex on very select occasions, to be honest, because it's extremely valuable now. The value of Rolexes has literally just taken off. It's unbelievable. And secondly, I do think it's very flash and showy to wear a Rolex like during a working day, you know what I mean? I mean, I wouldn't wear it when I go into a studio or anything like that. Well, I do sometimes, I have to say. But I do like, you know, big, bright blue and white and yellow watches because I think... Anyway, the point of my story is the people I was with, we then repaired to a pub just off Carnaby Street. I think it's called the White Horse. It's the White something.
Oh, a horse is as good as any.
Yeah, as good as any. A lovely bar, lots of people sitting around. And there were two people behind the bar, and there must have been 16 customers waiting to be served and a lot more sitting down at tables. So I said, oh, hi, you know, I'm very sorry. Food will, and this is no condemnation of the staff, by the way, you know, food will take X number of minutes. And I said, wow, I said, are you struggling? And, you know, the manager just came over to me and said, we simply can't get the staff. You know, we can't find people to work here, you know, and it's a very popular because it's a tourist trap and all that kind of stuff. We'd love to do more, but we're struggling. And if you saw what happened at Dover and Folkestone, you know, last weekend, it's all a question of numbers and people and staffing and all that. I think we've got a crisis.
We've got a major crisis. I was out at one of my private members clubs in Soho Friday before last with Mary Wilson for lunch. Do you remember Mary Wilson? She was Miss Beehive. Just What I Always Wanted was her big hit.
Hang on, she's not Mary Wilson of the Supremes.
No, Mary Wilson.
Oh, Mary Wilson, yeah.
Who was around in the 80s, and she had a big blonde beehive.
Okay.
That was her trademark look.
Right.
And she had a little band called the Wilsations, one of whom was, in the early days, Michelle Collins, who went on to star on EastEnders. So we prepare for a nice little lunch in a nice private members club with a roof garden. And I think we sat there for about 40 minutes before anybody came over and offered us a menu.
Yeah.
I had to go to the bar and ask whether I could order a drink.
Yeah.
And then that took another half hour. We were sitting there in the remains of the previous people's dirty plates and glasses and napkins
that.
And everything.
All that, yeah.
Nothing was cleared away.
Yeah.
This is a private members club that costs thousands of pounds to belong to every year.
Yes.
And they had one guy wafting around trying to do everything. And in the end, we said to him, have you got a staff shortage? Is there a crisis?
Yeah.
And he said, well, yeah, there's just the two of us.
Yeah, exactly. Do you know what I had to do in another pub last week? You're exactly what you've described. And there was a nice table that I wanted. I wanted to sit at the back there and read my papers and all that. Full of, you quite rightly say, used plates and all that. So I went to the bar and they thought I was going to start whinging and moaning. And I said, just give me your cleaning equipment, please. And they gave me a squeezy thing and some kitchen roll. And I went back and I cleaned it myself. I took all the stuff off, took it to the bar. I cleaned it out myself because that's the only way I felt that I could easily sit there and enjoy the ambience of the place. You know what I mean?
Well, very noble of you, but that probably compromises health and safety.
It probably does.
You know, you could be an asthmatic or something and you might have an extreme allergic reaction to the cleaning fluid or something. They shouldn't technically do that.
No, I agree. But in the White Horse one, it was clear there was only two people there. And when I got what I wanted, I had, in fact, a chia batter with... what's the green stuff that you scoop out?
Lettuce?
No,
cucumber?
No, the stuff you put on...
Pesto.
No, the stuff you put on toast. You know, the wealthy middle classes of Notting Hill eat it on toast.
Avocado.
Avocado, thank you. So I had an avocado and chicken chia batter, okay, with some skinny French fries, which is lovely.
I like the way you say chia batter.
Yeah.
That sounds quite sexy.
Yeah, chia batter.
It's a family show, though.
And the people I was with had a similar sort of sandwich. It took 40 minutes, but when they came... The girl just said, you know, thank you so much for being so patient, because other people were like, kept going back to the bar every 10 minutes, you know, where's my food? You know, that kind of stuff. But I understood we have got a crisis in the labour market in this country because we're too idle. And people these days, and I know everybody's going to say, oh, it's all down to Brexit. Oh, it's all down to COVID and all that. I think it's all down to idleness. I think people, you know, think it's beneath them to work in the service sector, to work in, you know, the, what do you call it, entertainment industry or
hospitality.
Hospitality, thank you. That's the word I was looking for. Whereas, in all the years I lived in America, and you were there as well, Miss Jones, to be a top professional barman in a, you know, a great bar in New York or California was actually a career. And it was something to be proud of, wasn't it?
Well, yes, but there's a vast difference between being a stylish barman in somewhere like the American Bar in the Savoy or some swanky hotel in Manhattan than it is in some crummy pub down the back of nowhere, you know, scraping chicken
harsh.
And chips off
that's
the floor.
A bit harsh. That's not White Horse, believe me.
That's not a career, is it? I think there is a difference. I don't think it's anything to do with people think it's beneath them, because we do have a system in the DWP these days where they have to go off, be sent off for job interviews and that kind of thing. Otherwise, they can't pick up their job seekers allowance. So I think it is the fact that we did rely very much on a workforce that came here from other countries elsewhere, primarily Eastern Europe, for example.
Yeah.
And, you know, Brexit has caused the loss of those people, whether we like it or not.
Right.
Look at all the friends we've had who've had their cheap Polish builder who's prepared to shin up a drainpipe and fix a couple of tiles on your roof rather than get scaffolding in at £3,000 a week.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's missing those people now. I know what they were doing was illegal for their own health and safety, but everybody's missing them now. And what's been going on down at Dover and Folkestone with the Channel ferries and the Channel tunnel is an absolute disgrace. And we can't blame it all on the French.
Well, you know, that is a pointing finger exercise. We're pointing fingers at them, they're pointing fingers at us. In the end, Brexit was going to cause readjustments to the way the country runs. We asked for a hard border, and now we've got to, you know, cope with that hard border. But I think people should have coped with it better. But anyway, there we go.
We've had 6 years to cope with it. I know that the pandemic came along. Yeah. We didn't factor in COVID when we came out of Europe. So that was a kind of blindside that we weren't expecting.
Yes.
But we have had 6 years, and we ought to be more on top of it by now. The way I feel at the moment, I don't want to travel anywhere.
No.
I've been to 3 different places this year because, you know, work and various commitments and so on. Mm. But I am now not inclined to go on a summer holiday. Mm. I'm inclined to stay home because I do not want to sit in my car for 21 hours. My car blows up, you know, I burn out, I get sick from that. Mm. And then you're facing that kind of thing on the way back as well.
No, I totally agree. How have you greeted the latest sort of extended version of how evil the interview with Diana, Princess of Wales, was, and the consequences to her and the ramifications which are still happening 25 years on?
I'm outraged by it. Of course the police should be involved. Of course there should be an investigation. They've refused it. And it makes me think that the police were in on it.
Yeah,
somehow.
I agree with that. I agree with that. That if they look back all this time, they'll find that very senior officers refused to act on something which should obviously have been attended to.
It's absolutely disgusting, and I have so much sympathy with Earl Spencer. I do, and also what William and Harry are being put through.
Yeah.
There's no question in my mind that Harry has experienced some sort of mental health dismantlement.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah.
And that he's now got this inflammatory book is about to publish, and he's going to go all into his relationship with his father. This is all hinged to the fact that he wasn't allowed to grieve properly over the loss of his mother.
Yeah.
But his mother shouldn't have died in the first place.
Yeah.
And had Martin Bashir not conducted this interview and fed ideas into her mind that weren't true. Mm. Things like Tiggy Leg Book, the nanny, being pregnant by Charles and having an abortion.
That's disgusting, isn't it?
It is disgusting.
Absolutely.
She has been paid £200,000 by the BBC.
Did you see
compensation?
You saw the picture of her coming out of court when that was settled. And, I mean,
yes,
it wasn't the Tiggy Leggy Book that we all remember as the nanny of Harry and William, was she? She looked like a woman whose face told the pain and suffering she'd been going through for the last 20 years to me.
Her life has been blighted by it, and she should not have had to put up with that. But by the same token, our licence fee should not be going to paying off people like her who have a grievance against the BBC.
Exactly, exactly. But then where do you get it from and who do you hold responsible? And why Bashir isn't being asked to answer at a much higher level?
He should be in prison as far as I'm
concerned. I agree with that. I mean, look, everybody can say, oh, you know, it's never been a fair trial over what he did and all that. I think there's plenty of blinking evidence knocking around about the extenuating. And, of course, Miss Jones, we're journalists. You and I have been journalists for a long time. And people love having a go at journalists. They like reading things in newspapers which are revelatory or scandalous. But they always have a go at the people who found all that stuff out. Oh, journalists, you know, nasty, horrible people.
Oh, we are the scumbags of the
scumbag. You hide in bushes and take pictures of people and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
Never done that in my life. I was once accused of going to a party wearing a microphone and recording the party secretly.
Really?
I had a pen tucked down the front of my shirt.
Yes.
I usually have a pen, as you've probably noticed when we've been out for a drink and so on.
Yeah.
There's a pen always there, just clipped to my shirt.
Sure.
And some flippant remark was made about, oh, you know, are you wired for sound?
Mm.
And I probably went, oh, yeah, you know, always wired for sound, me or something. It's a joke.
Yeah.
And I lost friends over it all these years. People have said she went to that party, she recorded us.
Wired up.
Yeah, it's got to be the journalist who's at fault. Yeah. And actually scrape that away. You know, look underneath. Mm. We are saying that Martin Bashir should be culpable for what happened to the Princess of Wales.
Absolutely. Gives journalism a very...
And she's probably dead because of him. I would go as far as to say that.
I would as well. I think she became so paranoid, you know, showing those bank statements. Oh, look, people are taking payments to dish the dirt on you. How could Martin Bashir make up a story that Charles had an affair with Tiggy Leggy Ball, which led to an abortion? And Diana was so convinced, she went up to her at a reception and said to her, oh, I'm so sorry to hear about the baby. I mean...
It's disgusting. The more I think about it, the more angry I get. Yeah, no. And, you know, some newspaper, some news organisation needs now to take this into their own hands and campaign to get this put right. That interview should never be shown on television again. Yeah. William was absolutely right, Prince William. You know, in his mother's honour and to spare them any more pain, those two boys and their own families, that interview with Diana, which is a false interview, people who've never seen it before are going to watch it if it airs again. Yeah. And they, like when they watch The Crown, they believe everything they watch. Oh, well, it was on The Crown, so it must be true.
Yeah.
They're going to watch the interview and say, well, okay, he said this, she said that. Actually, I believe that.
Yeah.
And we know now that it was completely false.
Well, completely false. Right, okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for listening to the current edition of Life on Planet Porky. The rock chick writer extraordinaire, of course, celebrating getting back into print in newspapers in, you know, something which Leslie Ann, you excelled at during your Fleet Street years, which were...
Oh, thank you. We had our run-ins, though, didn't we? Because we were on rival papers at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember you...
But it was all good fun, wasn't it? Being sent off on the same stories and trying to outdo each other and all the skullduggery. But it was all in good part, I always felt, you know, because at the end of the story, everyone would be in the pub together having a laugh about it. There was never anything spiteful or busy.
Oh, no. But I was always smarter than the average bear. I always...
Yes, you were.
I always slipped out of the pub, you know, if I thought I had an advantage and let everybody else keep on drinking and get away. I remember once down in Devon, there was a fantastic story about an Australian sheep farmer who suddenly inherited a baronetcy in Devon. He inherited a sort of manor house and something like 300 acres of land because his uncle had died and he was the only living relative. It was one of these, you know, typical stories you could make up. And he came back to Devon, took it over. First thing he did was he started shagging the wife.
Not a sheep.
Not a sheep. No, not a sheep.
We're not going down that path. No. Family show. Family show.
Family show, absolutely. He started shagging the wife of the guy who ran the estate. You know, the old Earl had died. This Australian farmer had been traced as his only living relative. He inherited it. He came. But, of course, there was an estate manager. But the Aussie thought that along with inheriting, you know, the manor house and 300 acres, he would inherit the estate manager's wife as well.
Or the shagging rights.
Yeah, the shagging
dear.
No, it's true. So, anyway... And I tell you, who's one of the people on that story was Stuart Higgins.
Higgy the Human Sponge.
Higgy the Human Sponge, who went on to become editor of The Sun, but we were all young reporters on the road in those days. And we're all in this pub, as you quite rightly say, in this little village on the edge of the estate and all that. And I went to the bar and got another couple of drinks, you know, and chatting to the barmaid and all that. And just literally talking to her, she'd only just sort of come on duty, she revealed to me the address of where the estate manager's shagged wife had fled to get away from...
The shaggy, as it were.
The shaggy, that's right. Yeah. And she'd gone and fled to her sister's council flat in an area of Plymouth, right?
As you do.
Yeah, exactly. So I said, really? And I said, I don't suppose you know the address, do you? And she said, oh, yeah, you know where it is. I've been there several times. Yeah.
That's like, whips out his West Country accent for good measure.
Yeah, she said something like, you know, Argyle Close, you know, in, and I said,
oh, it would be Argyle.
So I took the drinks back to the table, you know, and I put them on the table. I said, yeah, thanks. I'm just going for a leak. Of course, I leapt outside, right, jumped into my car, probably shouldn't have done, and roared off back down the road to Plymouth, found her, got a talk with her, right, filed it to the Daily Express at about 10 o'clock at night. They said, this is great. This is going to be the splash in the late editions. Because in those days, you could go up till sort of, I don't know, midnight, really, for the last edition. But
Were there three or four editions in those
days? Oh, five sometimes.
Five, okay, yeah. The first one would drop at about sort of 6 o'clock in the evening, would it, the previous night?
Yeah.
And then you'd go all through the night. So I remember when we were reviewing shows, we could only get the reviews in the final edition. Yeah.
That's right. But anyway, I was set for the splash in the third edition, which is the biggest seller, the main seller, okay? So you won't believe what happened. So I filed all this from a phone box, obviously, in Plymouth Borough, and then went back to the pub. And I got back to the pub at about 11:30. Right.
And they said, that was a long leak.
Yeah, that's right. Where have you been? I said, okay, guys, I'll hold my hands up. Because there was a code of honour. Once you'd filed, once you'd given it to your lot, once you knew it was in that next edition, you would then hand it over, okay? Because...
Absolutely, yes, and we all did that.
Otherwise, you couldn't work together.
So, exactly.
So I said, you won't believe it, I found the shaggy, as you've called her. well done, very happy.
I like that word.
Yes, that's right.
A new word.
I said, and Higgy said, what do you mean you found it? I said, yeah, I have. He said, where do you find it? I said, I can't tell you, but I've been to a council flat and I've got it and I filed it and it's going to be the lead in the third edition of the Express. However, guys, that deadline's gone now. I'm prepared to give it to you. You can get it in your last editions, okay? So guess what happened? At the Express, there was some kind of dispute with the printers.
Oh, no. I know what you're going to say.
My story never got in. But
oh, my God. And everybody else scooped you.
Everybody scooped me in their last edition.
Oh, well, I'm so sorry. That's one of those things you never get over, isn't it?
Never get over. I was so pompous, you know, and so, well, I got it. And I, you know. And of course, next morning, I was like maudlin with grief, you know. Started moaning to the news editor, who basically told me to F off, you know, and, you know.
Yeah.
You're a reporter. You get it here. We'll sort with it after that, you know. And I thought.
Oh dear. That pains me to listen to.
Yeah, exactly. But funny enough, it made Iggy and I bond quite a lot, you know. He was quite sympathetic the next day.
Great guy, Stuart. Yeah. I mean, he's taken a lot of flack over the years for various reasons.
Yeah.
But he's a great guy. He was very kind to my dad after he had his terrible accident, fell under the train.
Yeah.
And, you know, a good Welsh boy.
Yeah, yeah.
I loved the way he pronounced the name of his company car. He always called it a Peugeot.
That's right. Yeah. Like Peugeot, yeah.
Peugeot. Do you want to ride in my Peugeot?
That's right.
That's a euphemism.
Yes, I think we won't go there, Miss Jones.
Family.
Listen, I was going to say to you, we've discussed a lot of pop stars over the years on this column and all that kind of stuff, but one of the most intriguing to me, and he was 74 yesterday, is Cat Stevens.
One of my all-time favourites.
Well, there you go.
I was mad about him when I was young.
Renamed himself Yusuf Islam. And the reason why I'm so intrigued by this man is that he was an incredibly successful pop star. He was very handsome. He was of sort of Greek descent. And then suddenly, instead of all the booze and drugs and lots of shagging, I mean, he admits that, you know, one of the great regrets of his life now is that he, you know, had sex with so many of his friends' wives and girlfriends because he was a big pop star and he was very handsome. He suddenly went from that to being an imam in the Muslim faith. And I just can't work out how anybody can change their lifestyle from one of great excess with loads of money, take anybody you want, anytime you want, to the sort of life he went to. I've never been able to work it out.
Ah, well, there's a very simple explanation. You don't know what happened to him.
You'll go and tell me.
Well, he was in Malibu in California, and he was swimming off the bit of beach that he was on, and he nearly drowned. His life was saved, and he experienced profound religious conversion.
What?
Having not been able to find faith in... Sorry?
In a split second?
In a split second. I think it was his brother that gave him a copy of the Quran. Mm. And he hadn't been able to find the answers in the Christian faith or Judaism. He'd been very interested in...
Well, why was he looking for them? I mean, you know...
He wasn't looking, but when he almost drowned, and it was touch and go that he would survive,
right.
And then he just had this profound conversion and turned his back on his profligate lifestyle and, you know, the entertainment industry and the excesses thereof and all of that, and devoted his life to Islam. Mm. I went to interview him after this happened.
Right.
And he was...
Was he in his school then in North London?
Yes, he was in his school in North London. I remember it was Diane Abbott's constituency. So what was her constituency?
Well, I don't know. Somewhere around Lambeth.
I think it was somewhere near Edmonton. No, Lambeth is south.
No, you're right. You're right. Yeah. It was
and
like
I went
Tottenham,
into
this, Tottenham or Edmonton.
Yeah, I went into the school to speak to him. And I instinctively put my hand out to shake his hand.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't touch me. He put his hands together and sort of bowed slightly.
Yeah.
And then I suddenly thought, oh, I must be unclean because I'm a woman. You know, he can't touch me. Or a strange woman anyway. Yeah. And then we had this very sort of stilted interview. And he was not the Cat Stevens that I'd grown up on, if you like.
No.
But his original name was Yorgos, like George Michael.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Greek background. His family had a restaurant.
Yeah.
And they lived above it.
Yeah, amazing. My Lady Davenville. Dun, dun,
dun, dun, dun. That was beautiful. I tell you my favourite.
Why do you
was...
lie so still? Yeah, go on.
Father and Son, which is...
Yeah.
I've sort of been compiling a playlist over the years for when I die.
Mm.
A very dear friend of mine, Nick Fitzherbert, died a few years ago. And at his funeral, his lovely family gave out CDs at the door of the church as we all left.
Whose funeral was this?
Nick Fitzherbert, great friend of mine. He was a marvellous sort of marketing guru.
Right.
And he was a member of the Magic Circle. Mm-hmm. He could perform all these wondrous tricks. And he was a very knowledgeable guy, you know, and he was a massive music fan.
Yeah.
Particularly loved Keith Richards and Ronnie Wood. And there was a picture in the Order of Service of him with Keith on the back.
Right.
But they put together this CD of some of Nick's favourite tracks and gave us all a copy.
Mm.
And I thought, I have to do that, but it's going to take a long time for me to put that together.
Mm.
And so I've been compiling this list over time. There's about 40 songs on it at the moment, so that, you know, my kids, when the time comes for me to move on to the next realm, they will have all the songs there ready as a playlist and they can press that up and give it out to people at my funeral.
Yeah, well, that's very nice.
I might run it past you sometime, actually. I think you'll like all the songs on it.
I'm sure I will, but I won't be at your funeral, Miss Jones, because I will have gone many years before that.
Ah, you say that. We don't know. We have no way of knowing.
Matthew and Son.
Another lovely song.
Yeah.
And, of course, his rendition of Morning Has Broken.
Yeah.
Which another great friend of mine wrote the piano part for and played it.
Morning. Yeah.
That's the one. You know the beautiful piano introduction and the sort of trill that comes in the middle and so on?
Right.
That was composed by Rick Wakeman.
Golly, was it?
Formerly
of
the Straubs and and so on. And he was paid £9 for the session.
Golly,
and he said over all the years people have got in touch with him because they can't find that sheet music anywhere.
Right.
Because they want to record that song and they want the arrangement that he came up with.
Yeah.
And they get in touch with him and they say, where can we get the arrangement for Morning Has Broken? He goes, you can't.
Yeah.
Why not? Well, they must be somewhere. He goes, no, it's not. It's never actually been registered, published or anything.
Amazing.
And they go, can you give it to us? And he goes, no. And he holds on to that because it was something that was so precious.
Yeah.
And it's become like an all-time classic.
Mm.
But he was paid £9 for it and no royalties. So why should he give it away?
Golly, amazing. He's come back a bit, hasn't he, in later years? He's 74, by the way, which I found amazing as well, Cat Stevens, 74. But I have seen him in interviews over the last year or two, in which he'd come back a bit and he said, I still take the royalties because I need them to run my school and all that kind of stuff. I'm thinking of doing it. I think he's done a couple of gigs, hasn't he, publicly in the last couple of years? You know,
he may have done.
Yeah.
I've missed them myself.
Yeah.
But When I would have liked to see him live, I was too young to go.
Right.
You know, when he was just him and his acoustic guitar and he'd get up in the round. You can find footage on YouTube and so on. Yeah. And he'd just sit there in the round with his guitar and all the audience would sit around him in the venue. Sure. And I would love to have seen him in those days. I'm not really interested in seeing him now. But, you know, you say 74. Mm. 74 is young nowadays.
Well, I know, considering Macca's 80 and...
It's not old. Even 80 isn't old anymore. I've got quite a few friends who are in their 80s.
Really?
And they're dynamic people. Yeah. And I think it's because they do what they love. They're musicians or they're involved in the music industry in some way. They've always done it. It's always been the thing that's kept them going.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, I should mention Johnny Walker, BBC Radio 2, the Sounds of the 70s show on a Sunday afternoon.
Yes.
I'm his special guest next Sunday coming.
Wow, that's great.
Johnny's been doing that program for years and years, and he's 77.
Yeah.
But, of course, it's Sounds of the 70s, so that's his era of music.
Mm.
I was a kid then, but a lot of that music is what turned me on in the first place.
Yes.
And it's the music that so many of us still know and love.
Well, funny you should be talking about radio disc jockeys at the BBC. But as we're recording this now, Miss Jones, let me read this to you. Disc jockey, a new disc jockey named Noel Edmonds, 21, a former student teacher, is today taking over Kenny Everett's Saturday spot on Radio 1.
God, what was that about? I'm guessing about 1971, something like that?
July 1970.
Wow.
Amazing.
He was a big star, Noel, wasn't
he? Yeah. Did you ever come across him, interview him or anything?
In fact, we had a mutual friend. We still do have a mutual friend, Phil Swern, who is Phil the Collector Swern on Ken Bruce's programme on BBC Radio 2.
Yeah.
And so I met Noel quite a lot of times. Mm. He's a charming, charming man.
Yeah. My sister was working in commerce in those days, and she worked in the alcohol industry. And she introduced a new beer into this country. I can't remember what it was called now, but it's from America. And she was flying over to, believe it or not, Milwaukee all the time, where this beer, what was it called? It became a very famous bottled beer in this country. It's one of the early, you know, sort of American beers, you know. I can't even remember the name now. But for some reason, Noel Edmonds got involved. I don't know why. And he used to fly my sister around in his helicopter, piloting it himself.
Oh, yeah. He used to fly out of Battersea Heliport.
That's right, yeah.
And on the day of Live Aid, 13th of July 1985, right. He flew the artists down from Battersea Heliport to Wembley Stadium.
Golly, that's amazing.
He dropped them in the kind of car park behind.
Yeah.
So that they could perform, and then flew them back again. That was his contribution to the fundraising cause.
Oh, I see, yeah. Well, wish I could remember the name of this beer that my sister brought to this country from Millwall.
Sounds like you drank a bit too much.
Well, I must have drunk too much in those days. Anyway, getting away from beer to the fact that I have literally given it up for the last week during the heatwave, and I am now a devotee, Miss Jones, of pure chamomile Twinings tea. What do you think about that?
Well, I saw your tweet on that, and it made me laugh a bit, actually. I'm not laughing at you. We've talked about chamomile tea on this podcast before because I've advocated it to you as a way of getting to sleep. I always have, and I have had for years, chamomile tea at bedtime, and it knocks me out just like that.
Wow.
There's a very special one. I know that other brands are available, but I choose the Marks & Spencer chamomile and honey tea bags, organic, and they've just got a nice little edge of a flavour on them, and you get the little flowers in a bag, little sort of net bag.
Right.
So they're nicer than the paper ones that you can get from other brands.
Really?
I strongly recommend that you try them. You will never go back to the ones you're using now.
Do you put anything in your chamomile, like a drop of lemon or a drop of milk?
No, absolutely not. I don't drink milk anyway.
I find it.
Well, you just wait for it to cool down.
Yeah.
A little bit. Take it up to, and also the other trick is don't drink it downstairs or wherever you have your sitting room.
Yeah.
In front of the television, because you will just conk out.
Mm.
So I make mine just before I'm going to go and get into bed. Right. So I get ready for bed, do all that, have a shower, do all the thing, go downstairs, make the chamomile tea, take it off and drink it in bed because it knocks me out so quickly.
Well, actually, I've been drinking it all day. Like Sunday yesterday, I had about 12 cups of it. And it just...
No, you don't want to drink it during the day because it relaxes you too much.
Well, I find it just very refreshing. You know what I mean? I mean, you...
Well, have honey and lemon tea during the day or mint tea.
But
save the chamomile for bedtime.
You can drink water, but water's sort of nebulous, isn't it? It's just water, you know what I mean? It doesn't really take money.
I tell you what's nice. If you make honey and lemon tea, or indeed mint tea, and then cool it right down. Don't put it in the fridge when it's still very, very hot with the boiled water. Yeah. Cool it right down in a jug and then put it in the fridge and then have it with ice cubes and a slice of lemon. Yeah. That's really nice.
Yeah, that's great.
Now, I'm sounding like Jamie Oliver, aren't I?
Yeah, well, that's all right. I know. Now, one of the towns closest to me, Miss Jones, is Sutton in Surrey, okay? Or I live further down in Stockbroker Belt. I am astonished to find that the value of some properties I own in Sutton have suddenly started climbing. And I rent the properties out, and the people who look after them have been sending me messages saying you can now look for a 15% increase in rentals and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's a business I've been in for a lot of years, and I leave it to other people to sort it out. And I thought, I wonder what this is all about. I've suddenly found out that this town, Sutton, has become a magnet for people from Hong Kong who are leaving Hong Kong because it's become more oppressive under the complete rule of China, which, by the way, I'm not having a go at. We handed Hong Kong back to China. As far as I'm concerned, China run their properties the way they want them, and we run our society the way we want them. People in Hong Kong who were used to living there under UK ownership have now decided they want to come here. But I've noticed, I was in Sutton the other day, there are a lot of Hong Kong people here. All of a sudden...
How do you know they're from Hong Kong?
Because, A, they look Asian, and B, they are going into estate agents and talking to estate agents who I have to deal with my property, and they are from Hong Kong, and they are looking for properties to buy and to rent. And already a supermarket is opened in the high street selling only Chinese food products. It's amazing.
Oh, I love a Chinese supermarket. Yeah. There's a couple of brilliant ones in Soho.
Right.
You know, down off, is it Gerrard Street?
There's
a couple of really good ones there. I've got quite a big group of friends who are Malaysian Chinese.
Right.
And the men in the relationships came over from Malaysia to study as accountants in the Aldershot area. That's also, that's Hampshire, isn't it? Just the next one on from Surrey. And married English girls and stayed here. Mm. And there's quite a big gang of this. I met two of the sisters way back when I was about 17 and went on my first holiday to Spain without my parents and met these sisters, and we stayed friends. And then they all married these Chinese accountants.
Right.
So, and we've been to a Chinese restaurant in Sutton, which was really good.
Right.
And so there does seem to be something in what you're saying, but I'm interested to know what makes Hong Kong Chinese different from any other kind of Chinese.
Well, I have no idea. Hong Kong's one of the few places in the world I've never been to. I've never been to China, I've been to Hong Kong. I've been everywhere else, but I have an ambition to go to Hong Kong. But I'm not Eastern, you know, I've not got any great ambitions to go to the Philippines or Malaysia or anything like that. I've always been Western. I've always wanted to go to America and South America and Australia, you know what I mean?
Do you like Chinese cuisine?
Oh, I love Chinese cuisine.
Oh, so do I. Absolutely
love it.
Absolutely all of it. I love Asian food.
So do I. But shops which were previously sort of closed down are now reopening. And they've become like upper-class sort of clothing shops and this kind of thing. It's quite remarkable. Cobham used to be a little town in Surrey where nothing much happened. And then Chelsea Football Club built their training ground on the edge of Cobham, one of the best in the world. And all of a sudden, Chelsea players started living there. And Cobham now is literally, per head capita, one of the wealthiest little towns in the country. If the people come and they're wealthy, they put money into the local community, you know, and it's an amazing thing, but there we are. Right.
If you build it, they will come.
I think you're absolutely right.
Name that film.
What was that film?
If you build it, they will come.
Oh, yeah, what was that?
That was Field of Dreams, one of my all-time favourite movies. Okay. Kevin Costner, yeah. About the guy, the farmer, who builds a baseball diamond among his fields.
Yeah.
Oh, what a brilliant film. I have to go and watch that again now.
Absolutely. Right, okay, folks, that's it for another week. Thank you very much indeed for joining Miss Jones and myself here on Planet Porky. And we will be back with you. And again, I'm sorry because my mouth is wobbling with the amount of Novocaine I've got in my gob. We'll be back with you this time next week. Whilst I was there, I passed a swatch shop. And I thought, time for a new fun watch. So I went and bought a new watch for £125.
That's a bit different from a Rolex.
It is very different to a Rolex. Rolex.
Have you stopped wearing your Rolex?
I only wear my Rolex on very select occasions, to be honest, because it's extremely valuable now. The value of Rolexes has literally just taken off. It's unbelievable. And secondly, I do think it's very flash and showy to wear a Rolex like during a working day. You know what I mean? I mean, I wouldn't wear it when I go into a studio or anything like that. Well, I do sometimes, I have to say. At the Express, there was some kind of dispute with the printers.
Oh, no. I know what you're going to say.
My story never got in, but...
Oh, my God, and everybody else scooped you.
Everybody scooped me in their last edition.
Oh, well, I'm so sorry. That's one of those things you never get over, isn't it?
Never get over. I was so pompous, you know, and so, well, I got it, and I... And, of course, next morning, I was, like, maudlin with grief, you know. Started moaning to the news editor, who basically told me to F off, you know, and, you know.
Yeah.
You're a reporter, you get it here, we'll sort with it after that, you know, and I thought...
Oh, dear. That pains me to listen to.
Yeah, exactly. I wish I could remember the name of this beer that my sister brought to this country from Millwall.
Sounds like you drank a bit too much.
Well, I must have drunk too much in those days.